Marilyn Nandam performs Julius Eastman's piece, The Holy Presence of Joan d'Arc. In this pre-recorded piece, he plays all 10 cello parts. Experience it free on Suwannee TV at suwanneeperilpopolo.org Thursday, April 1st at 8 p.m.
Intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to CKUT.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds, sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds of change.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised. Hey everyone, on today's show, I sat down with two friends who are both chronically ill and disabled, queer writers and artists living in Montreal or formerly living in Montreal, MX Marin and Celie Quest. We talked a lot about the pandemic and kind of what it meant to be someone who is chronically ill or disabled, living and watching the reality of the world react to pandemic life. They also shared some of their work. We mused about dreams. It's a really great episode, so thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
I'm a labyrinth of hopes and fears, of tears, of frustration and of anger. But if you can break through this wall and search amongst it all, you'll find a man there who has a heart of love, who is afraid of getting jaded, growing older. Someone to love him through life's winter when the weather grows a little colder.
How are you both this morning on this snowy morning?
I'm doing all right. A bit of a chaotic past 80 hours, let me tell you. But I mean, maybe we can talk about that while we talk about it on this. it's very sunny here today, which is nice.
Yay. Yeah, we haven't had the sun quite yet this morning in Montreal, but perhaps. Yeah, we had plenty of it yesterday, so that's all good. I'm okay. I'm grumpy. I decided to express my grumpiness in an email to a couple disabled people, actually, that I've been in this, like, international disability arts support project with, but they made a choice that was not especially inclusive, and the communication has gone very lacking. So I have some feels about it and let them know. And I think that things will improve in some way or other. It's just like, oh man, did we really have to get to this particular juncture? Some feels about that. Yeah, otherwise, like, I had this actually kind of amazing dream that I was sad that my alarm woke me up from today, wherein something happened, some kind of accident, and both my feet had to be amputated. But it was so chill. I was like, sweet. Now I'm like, okay, I'm in the prosthetics using Amputee Club, and I can learn finally this amputee-centered, like, semi-competitive fun game that my homies are playing. And I was learning the game and, like, flirting with this other cute amputee that I was now gonna... And, like, the last thing that I said in the dream when I was meeting someone who had feet and who had only recently known me to have feet, I just made a, like, to get her up to speed on my change, I just, like, made a gesture with my fingers of, you know, human to walking legs and was like, I got no footsies. That was super funny. I don't know what this, I've definitely never had this dream before. I'm really not sure what it's all about, but it felt like super chill. I was like, okay, a different disability. I'm gonna start living this life now. It's all good. It was very, like, pleasant, actually.
I'm just rolling with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
How have your dreams been, MX?
I think my dreams have been very tinged with solitude lately. I tend to dream quite actively around the new moon and the full moon, and otherwise very little, which is kind of annoying. I wish I'd dreamt more. Since last year, I moved out to this small town where I don't know anyone. So my dreams lately have been about seeing old friends and making new friends, or participating in like group activities or learning from people or going on, field trips type deal. So I think there's something of, like, a longing for companionship, which in my waking hours is rather dealt with. And I don't think these dreams are particularly desperate, but they bring to bear that that need that I'm feeling for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been dreaming a lot about family lately, which is interesting. I think all of my family is out west, and recently my cousin died of poison supply. He was struggling with addiction for many years, and I just learned this recently, to start introducing, like, poison supply into the discourse around what is, you know, commonly termed, like, overdose related deaths, because a lot of them are not overdoses, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think what it meant, because of COVID, I haven't been back out west for quite a while, and I think that death particularly, you know, like, my family is quite small, they don't really deal with grief well. A lot of, like, alienation and unresolved trauma in the family, and it's been an interesting time, I guess, being away from that, and I, for whatever reason, my family has been coming up a lot in my dreams.
Good. That's a hard turn.
Yeah.
Maybe your dreams can help inform you in some way about what you can exchange with your family, whether it manifests directly or not.
Yeah. It was interesting what MX was saying about how, you know, able to kind of deal with it in the day-to-day, but then all of the stuff in the dreams is the stuff that's unresolved, perhaps, and that we're kind of forced to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I really resonated with that, so.
Yep.
Yeah, dreams are teachers.
Before we go any further, maybe let's roll things back a bit. Is it okay if y'all introduce yourselves to the audience?
You know, very formally, officially, hi, my name's MX Marin. I'm a chronically ill, blind, trans, non-binary person who enjoys writing. I live in a small coastal town, 49 degrees north on the south shore of the St. Lawrence River, where I am very concerned with listening to the sounds of the ice melting and learning how to play my steel drum. Yeah, right now I'm working on a memoir about chronic illness, tentatively titled Questions for a Blood Doctor, and I'm looking for an editor in case anyone listening wants to work with me.
I'm in the side stream of being excited to learn about MX's steel drum. I didn't know.
I mean, wait, I can do this. Yeah, I got it as a birthday present for myself. It has, it's from Eastern Europe, Ukraine, I think. Yeah, and it has two koi fish engraved on it, you know, in like the classic yin-yang style. Mm-hmm. One of them is mostly brass with like some silver outline, and one of them is mostly silver engraving with the brass of the drum. It, filling in the details, it's been bringing me a lot of joy. You know, it's like I was really looking for a musical instrument that I could improvise with that did not require rigor in learning how to play. Mm-hmm. You know, like if like the flute or something would take me years to get comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And importantly, that requires no electricity to use. You know, like it required machines to make, and that's fair enough. But all the instruments I've like enjoyed playing with in the past have been like synthesizers and like theremins, electronic music instruments. Mm-hmm. And while those appeal to me and the sounds appeal to me, I wanted something that I could like take outside my house and play just like, you know, in the woods, on the beach, by the fire, whatever, without a battery. I'm very glad to have this now.
I love it. We never talked before about my personal love of steel drum also.
Oh, I did not know this. Yeah, that's awesome.
My own aspiration to get into playing that someday, so yay, I love this.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love this without a battery image. Mm-hmm. MX, the mm-hmm. first time I guess didn't meet you but saw you perform was at one of Seely's shows on Fairmount in the Mile End, and right. You were very much tuned into a lot of synthesizers.
yeah I remember, that was a great night.
Your being was very much in the expanding into these machines. It was a great set.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Celia, I can introduce myself if you're still thinking, and
yeah, please, let's do that.
Yeah. So I mean, like, some of my listeners know who I am. I feel like other listeners may just know me as the voice, the voice behind the box or behind the curtain. I'm Kai Ryla. I'm a chronically ill trans non-binary person as well. Having conversations with myself recently and with friends about trans femininity. I am of mixed Eastern European ancestry, predominantly Finnish, and I am currently doing a lot of work to unpack the history of Finnish settlement in Canada. I'm learning the Finnish language right now, and my research is really focused on Finnish settler colonialism lately and how Finns were involved in the labor movement in Canada, and how this kind of workers' discourse that Canada uses to dispossess Indigenous people. That's me.
Great. I just learned some things.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome that you're like undertaking the work of learning the language of your heritage. Like, I'm like French English on one side, and I mean I know those languages and am vaguely familiar with the devastation that my family has wrought in this land. You know, not intimately familiar, unfortunately, but vaguely familiar. On the other side, though, I'm like Romanian Jewish, and my father was born in the modern state of Israel a few years after the establishment of that state. And he then immigrated to Canada as a child. And so, like, that's something that I feel so disconnected from. You know, like, in my studies lately, I've been, like, reading Torah and getting better acquainted with Abrahamic religions in general as, like, a means of accessing that. But there's something about the language, you know, like, Hebrew feels so inaccessible to me. But then so does Romanian. and it's it's really interesting. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, language is quite the rabbit hole. I think it's really fascinating to learn about the roots of Uralic languages, you know, coming from the Siberian regions of what is now, you know, the state of Russia, and making their way through Europe and being quite all over the place in Europe. Romanian is also a really interesting language itself, because, you know, it's language theorists kind of trace back the origins of the Romanian language to be like a dialect that came from the suburbs of Rome and like a people that went to what is now Romania and kind of started to, you know, cross, fornicate, whatever. And so it's like this language that was transmuted from what was like the Roman Empire. And one theory is that it's this like kind of banlieue type Roman.
That's really neat.
Interesting.
But yeah, and I mean, like, Finland is a, you know, an ethnostate that pushed the indigenous Sami people hundreds and, you know, thousands of years ago out of what is now known as Finland. And right. The Finns were also colonized by the Russians. And yeah, there's a lot there.
I lived in Poland for 3 months once upon a time. And that's been basically the extent of my direct experience in Central Europe so far. I have bardzo trochę polska now, very little left of the language. And still interest to perhaps in some context revisit someday and get a current sense of what all is happening amongst the international dynamics and histories there.
What sent you to Poland?
I needed to get the hell out of the US. yeah. So, okay, I'll give a little quick context on this and then otherwise introduce myself. This is Seeley speaking. And yeah, so once upon a time, I was experiencing what I would now describe as a kind of unidentified disability-related breakdown, like in terms of cognitive stuff, emotional stuff. I had a mental health crisis when I was, well, honestly, it was starting like well along when I was 18. It got worse when I was 19 and then 20. So yeah, I was 20. I was in college. I had already withdrawn early from one semester when I was 19 because shit just got too hard at school. And then I was like, all right, I can go back, except that going back needs to be in some kind of study abroad thing. I need to get away from where I am. And there was this inaugural study abroad opportunity being proposed to go to Krakow for this season, for 3 months, focusing on, at the time we were calling it Eastern European literature and politics. The person who had been my faculty advisor was one of the two faculty leading this initial program. And I knew that they needed a baseline level of participants to make it viable and go. And I was like, great, I qualify. You need people. I was interested to apply to go study on a different program that existed in England, but it needed a certain grade point average. I didn't have that. My grades were really fluctuating and starting to falter at that point. So yeah, it was strictly like, get me the fuck out of the US drama and pain. And turned out to be quite a valuable learning experience, also with its own pain. There was like quite a bit of isolation that I would say I ended up experiencing there while having, like, gaining just enough Polish to be able to navigate around the city of Krakow. You know, solo, I could get myself, you know, food in the shops and just kind of minimal essential conversation that way. But there was a lot of time that all of the participating students had to explore apart from our required classes together, and not having a way to make like a deeper social connections, especially. I made a couple connections with some locals while I was there, but you know, the language and cultural barrier was quite real. And as I think about it right now, it was really less accessible to me in that way than moving to Montreal, where there's still quite a bit of language barrier, but also a whole other level of access established with the English that is present here. There's a lot I could say. I came out queer in Poland. I changed and learned and did a lot of things.
Nice. I mean, yeah, like getting away from a place is as good an impetus as any to go somewhere else. Love that.
But yeah, to introduce myself a bit more, hello, I'm Seeley Quest. I have been in Montreal now, well, this June, it will be 4 years, God is willing. I get there the next few months, it'll be 4 years. And I am from the US originally. I am trans and identified, and also non-binary is accurate, I suppose, to describe. I tend to describe myself as gender fluid a bit more. I have multiple disabilities, and I'm working in writing, performing, facilitating. I also identify as an environmentalist. I am, when possible, working on curating and kind of organizing mixed art medium events, including the cabaret that Kai and MX were both at. Also, yeah, different kinds of writing, different genres, but yeah, writing's been a long practice. And the kind of different engagement with performance. My parents worked in theater. I grew up with that. I'm having a lot of focus on play script writing right now myself, but also did a ecological assessment for the book version of Buddies in Bad Times. This is a queer theater in Toronto, having a version of their annual winter rhubarb festival that manifested in the form of a print book as well as an audiobook component. So I did some pretty involved research on the ecological impacts of the different performing and authoring participants' contributions, and presented that as sort of a piece of analysis and assessment that's available online in PDF. That was just a recent, like, the last couple months project. Cool. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, maybe I could ask you to share some of the writing that you've been working on.
Yeah. Would you like to start, MX?
Sure. So I'm going to share three paragraphs from a piece called Sickness in Limbo that came out near the beginning of March and is available on my site. Before the time of remote friendships, in a limbo reserved for the sick, I found a certain comfort in breaking bread with others outside of time, those among whom compassion did not ring hollow. We suffered together. We empathized. My malady differed from yours in the minutiae, but sickness breeds a hearth around which we gathered and kept warm. I reached out to the fire, grateful, for here were those whose company was not charity, whose I'm sorry was not pity, where there was no pretense of putting on a brave face, no imperative to make comfortable, those who somehow still believed that they were healthy and so they would remain. Now, linear time shattered, stuck at home yet not missing the event, uncanny the speed with which life moved online. At first this seemed, perhaps, a respite from loneliness, illness, sickness, finally getting some of the attention it deserves. But then, why speak up on illness when it is already always on everyone's mind? What are we to gain as friends engaged in the eternal pursuit of joy from reminding each other that sickness exceeds even that mass media morass from which we struggle to escape? Why write of sickness in times of pandemic? What comes from devoting always more energy to illness? The problem has transmuted. No longer is writing and speaking on illness needfully concerned with convincing and reminding the temporarily healthy that the bodily certainty with which you live your lives is illusory. The sick reject the fiction of health even as it rejects us. We are devising strategies for living sick lives. There is no plotted course, no long-term plans amidst illness, but it is not the end.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I could share from a text that I have written somewhat recently. This is kind of an excerpt of sections from a longer piece called Messages in Bottles. I would say it's still in progress to be developed more. So the messages are a correspondence between two queer characters. Reaching an edge of Montreal bordered by the St. Lawrence River, you pitch the message. Sees service dog scouts along the waterline nearby, finds and fetches the bottle. Dear C, I miss you. You ever consider the fact of being in 5 big car and bike crashes so far, and that you've had at least 5 concussions in adulthood? And so can't venture again without crampons after an ice storm. Risk slipping to head slam repeats. You can't forget, even though your memory's narrator has become less reliable. I like you describing me as a, quote, lame love. The edge we know you can push with how intimately you've treated me, how public you've been about your own episodes of halting, encumbered, and staggering movement. I like the humor, sincerity, and especially that you checked first and didn't assume it would feel okay to use that. More disabled folks have tried reclaiming gimp and cripple than lame. It's still a put down daily. So you know it requires explaining to potential allies that I sometimes limp. My knees are damaged and mobility impaired even if I can bike most of the time. We must remind all that's what it means and that we pair it with love for how we physically operate. Now that we've entered a pandemic, numbers of us will grow. Can we dispel ableism and grow those willing to name themselves part of their community? We are many and strong, still facing gaps in care, still undermined by isolation. I go on faith you'll get this message and reply. Water, current, a border crossing habitat of mixed fluids, the effort of bottle containing, gambling, trust. These will bring precious words back to me. Waiting and seeking, Q. C returns to make a solid toss into waves. Her next message will go downstream, but a humpback whale heading upriver carries the vessel. It washes up where Q stumbles over it. Dear Q, I slide with you into this surreal space, breaking the logic for constructing our narratives. Resist the pressure of clarifying whose voice, what's non-fiction, etc. I couldn't even fabricate a missive how I wished, just got lucky a whale arrived to carry it. As someone said at the end of May, when whale came to Montreal, humans, whales, and land mammals sometimes are vagrants that go in unusual places. We, I think it's a crypt too, to ally with for stubborn cross-species survival. We're on me through exhaustion, communication errors, numbed hands, dislocated heads, with jouissance nonetheless. We embrace joyous energy even more, knowing that's so precious. Each casting notes forth to be transmitted, depending only on safe enough passage to carry them, and on adventurous receivers to actively adopt the messages. Merci for engaging in this ritual practice alongside me. For attuning to what's floating in the mix. laying at hold the wayward muse, hints, admissions, and commitments. We must believe our records will be found and yield future story building. In hope, yours.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for sharing.
What was that line near the beginning about memories, narrator becoming less reliable, but not forgetting? Is that how it went?
Yeah. Yeah, so the line before is referring to multiple concussions and considering the fact of that, and then that line was, you can't forget even though your memory's narrator has become less reliable.
Yeah, that really resonates. Like, over the past few days, I had some intravenous treatment, and then like late release migraine really hit me. And it was rough, but then as it's passed, I'm just like, oh, it's really fascinating to me that I can remember being in pain, but not physically remember the pain, you know?
Yeah, our mind-body matrices do so many different things to kind of stagger those experiences sometimes, you know? Not always synchronize.
How do you think of that? Like, the fact that we remember pain differently than we experience it?
I think it's a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, sure. It loves to go on, right? Like, people talk about how people who have been pregnant and then go through childbirth, there's some kind of hormonal influence that also happens that actually induces those people to forget a certain extent of the physical pain of the childbirth experience.
Right, which introduces them into the idea that they may give birth again.
Yeah, exactly. It's biologically necessary. To not be retaining the full, like, imprint and recognition of how much pain it is. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think that's an excellent microcosm for how we deal with it kind of psychologically, more generally, you know. I don't think that, let's say, like, after a period of time has elapsed and someone has integrated their past experiences in such a way that they're no longer re-traumatizing themselves by remembering them. When such a process happens, then something similar has happened, right? Like, we've kind of alchemized our past memories into something that allows us to continue experiencing the present, and conceive of new possibilities and options rather than solely reliving the pain, which is a sort of bringing back of the past into the present when it's not integrated, when it is really in the form of a flashback, right? Like, that's just bringing back, like, oh, okay, I now feel pain now again.
Right.
Kind of an illusion, but not an illusion for the time that it is being experienced, definitely.
Yeah, I want to riff on that and to bring up the line that was in your piece of writing, MX, on the illusion of health. I guess that a lot of the so-called able-bodied people that walk amongst this earth experience, and just that being like maybe an illusion, you know, that tries to rewrite their growing pains, you know, of youth, or, you know, because we all experience the pains of the body. For some reason, I just thought of growing pains and how, like, I don't have a memory of it, but from what I hear about how the body of an infant and child grows into an adult, it's a painful process, which is experienced differently through different bodies, right? Differently abled bodies, but I feel like the human experience with memory and pain, even for those who may feel that they identify more as being able-bodied, has kind of smoothed over a history and a memory of pains of the body.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, that's just it. Like in common parlance, we're just not supposed to acknowledge pain, right? We're not supposed to acknowledge that its ongoingness, its recurrence, its presence. And I mean, like, I think a lot, that's almost easy for me to forget, depending on who I have conversations with in a given week. Because I think that among the chronically ill and the disabled folks that I know, like, it's so commonplace to just talk about the facts of the body. Mm-hmm. But then I talk to some like older friends of mine who I knew who I got to know as a teen, for example, you know, friendships of circumstance that I cherish dearly, but whose experience of life is wholly removed from mine. And I'm really struck by how alienated from their own experience of their body they seem to be. Mm-hmm. Almost as if, like, I mean, I've come to view chronic illness as a call to awareness, right? As a call to presence. And I think that not having the imperative imposed upon you to acknowledge that your own body is fallible, it's really easy to fall into the sort of like technological illusion of the body as a machine that we are little like operators of, sitting at a control panel looking at a screen, right? Like that wholly like disembodied view of embodiment, paradoxically. It seems like living with pain, living with sickness, I mean, like, one really interesting idea that came out of disability studies is bodily doubt, right? Like this idea that we can't trust the body to operate exactly how we would previously have expected it to. So living with bodily doubt, for shorthand, is just a call to always expect the unexpected. And I think that's, well, when accepted and integrated, is really joyful, because being present is joyful, if difficult.
Yeah, I would like to add, ongoing in the dominant cultural context, to be learning that and living that. I'm not so sure of any people besides those who are actively in a... I feel like nuns, monks, other varieties of spiritual adepts who have daily practices are folks who maybe have a bit more of an ongoing grounding in this being present and being able to be there with what is. But that's a minority of people in our contemporary culture. And it's kind of remarkable to me that it's still the lifelong work to be able to face and embrace what is actually happening in our bodies and in our worlds, the microcosm and macrocosm. That, not saying don't try, I'm just making a comment about, I think it's more about forgiveness for those of us who find ourselves dissociated repeatedly, and just to acknowledge that it really is, it's not made easy for us to give that attention and practice and presence daily in our majority culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, that there are very many barriers to access, you know, like, specifically because it requires devoting time to nothing but, right? And like that is, yep. That's kind of anathema to how time is structured currently.
Anti-capitalist, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Hell, like, fucking taking up a meditation practice is anti-capitalist. I mean, not if you're trying to, like, become a better, more productive worker, but as a means of experiencing your own body.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask the both of you, I feel like in both of your pieces of writing, there was a lot of observation going on about what it means to kind of be sick or disabled and be writing about that throughout pandemic times. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know your observations, frustrations, joys, I guess, about larger, I guess, human cultural reactions to the pandemic and to, yeah, just this idea of like what it means to be experiencing a pandemic as someone who actively identifies as being sick or disabled and experiencing that.
I have some thoughts. Do you want to go ahead, MX?
Oh, you go, go.
I'll try. So one first thing coming to mind is that I wasn't able to stabilize more in a certain way once the pandemic came to this part of the world than I had been living before. So specifically just in terms of economics, I was in the most broke period of my life so far, and like just really strictly living on loans and generosity of, you know, various friends with like zero income, getting free food, you know, wherever I could, and just like completely scrambling nonstop for multiple months. And I can attribute, you know, that amount of scrambling and having gone into a complete destitution as it is disability related. It has to do with like cognitive stuff around management, yeah, just basic executive function choices. And to some extent, there's, you know, there's factors of like being trans that limiting some of my employment options, being a person who is apparently very slow in learning the language French, and that limiting a ton of options. But in any case, I've lived well under the poverty line for the great majority of my adult life, and you know, that's not new. I'm adaptable and scrappy, and I found that when the level of crisis was externalized and it wasn't just about, okay, Seeley's in a personal enough money to live crisis, but when it became widespread and just across the board people were entering economic crisis, the fact of different mutual aid practices becoming, you know, relevant to folks, and the fact of then people trying to just do more sharing around any kind of resources that could be available from the state or other sources, that contributed, you know, that kind of shit of people being like, oh, people in general need help. This also includes you. And just also to be clear, like I was getting some help that was keeping me afloat. I'm eternally grateful. But more was able to come through in my case. And so it's just an indicator of there's many different ways that I feel about being disabled living through my first pandemic. But this comment on the fact is just one of them, about the aspect where I was operating in such a kind of haphazard, you know, barely getting along by the seat of my pants kind of mode that once, quote, business as usual had to interrupt and attention started being more kind of regularly shared to people's just general well-being and subsistence, that ended up connecting me with more opportunities than I had access to before. I am not commenting that everything has been all good by any means. I ended up eventually also having a mental health crisis around about June, and life is not all sunny at all, but I feel like there's something, yeah, just something I wanted to say there about the status of having so much difficulty while disabled and then things shifting.
Yeah, that resonates quite a bit with my experience. There are parallels for sure. When pandemic hit, I was a full-time student finishing up. I didn't have a job for the first time in a while and was kind of just like expecting to get some summer gig renewed. But then because I had worked a lot the previous year and not being in school, I was eligible for government funding. Over the past year, I've pretty much gotten the government allocations monthly, and that has been greater financial stability than I've ever had in my life previously. And the unstructured time devoted to rest has also been quite a boon. But it's interesting how that's kind of contrasted with, I guess, the widespread awareness, awakening of, well, like facing death. I don't think there's any better way to put that. Many people I know were coming face to face with their own mortality for the first time as pandemic hit. And that was made a lot worse and continues to be made a lot worse by the sort of terrifying rhetoric that is deployed through various channels. And so there's a certain contending with this fact that I found to be, the circumstances for it were new because everybody was sharing a certain experience, but it seems like anyone who had previously had to face their own mortality had a somewhat easier time of that. And the isolation is another issue, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that, like, those of us who are living alone, especially at the start of pandemic, had quite a struggle.
Yep.
But I don't know. I mean, just like for me personally, I got to like reevaluate what it is that I want to do with my life. And that's great. I think that's pretty valuable. And I'm glad I got to do that without working 40 hours a week.
Word.
But I mean, like, it's a mixed fucking bag, you know?
Yeah, I'm thinking especially how this whole sort of thing has opened up, where people are able to explore new things, experience things differently, be faced with different types of conversations, renegotiate boundaries and like consent. And then we're seeing that people are really ready to just get back to quote unquote normal, right?
Yeah, as if that were like real.
Yeah, but it's also just like they're afraid of what they had to like face perhaps during the pandemic. And it was like, okay, that's enough dealing with my mortality. Like,
right.
Back to like the, you know, the keeping really, really busy. Don't think about death. Instead of being like, wow, yeah, life is short. Health is an illusion. Maybe we should restructure our entire economy. Maybe we should restructure like the ways that we live and relate to each other. And I mean, like, it's not like everyone is saying, I think a lot of people have been transformed for the good because of what they've experienced through personal reflection, mutual aid, et cetera. But you know, there's a lot of avoidant tendencies amongst many humans, and a lot of things that are perhaps pushing people to want to be like, then that's enough of that, and I'm going back to like what keeps me busy and away from, you know, working on perhaps the difficult task of radically transforming our communities and our lives.
And like, on some level, fair enough. That's, I think that's overwhelming for any individual to attempt, for sure. But I don't think we ultimately have any other choice.
Yeah, there's a great opportunity, as I'm noticing my own clinging. Clinging and attachment to ideas of stability. It's okay. It's okay to be doing what's imposed for us at this time, and yeah, reformulating how we live and how we might go forward. And sure, there's plenty to be afraid of, but we're in the process together. It's not an individually experienced trial at this time. So I think that just the fact of, yeah, enough people, a critical mass of us from here and there around the world who, you know, as MX just said, like, must, like, we're just going to have to figure out a different way of going forward. Yeah, I think there is going to be some degree of useful transformation coming out of this, along with just incredible grief and incredible amounts of challenge to process all of it at once. I have one last thing to comment. Maybe it's of will feel useful. An old mentor of mine has a statement that has stuck with me for a long time, which is, everything is getting worse and worse, and better, faster and faster. I feel like that pretty much says it, just that we're in this acceleration as the planet keeps moving along of both, yeah, good things and bad things continuing to develop kind of exponentially. And it's our challenge as humans, both with great intellect and with great, like, body vulnerability, to manage our best way through this circumstance and to decelerate the worse and worse and increase the better and better parts.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. You're both wonderful friends of Queer Core, and I look forward to continuing conversations around queerness and illness and disability and how we can forge forward through all of this.
Thank you so much for having me on, Kai. This was a great pleasure.
Yeah, really, thank you too. Very happy to be in the convo, and MX, I miss you. Thanks, Kai.
Here's a fortune to adorn you. I'll whisper in the night to you. Promise to adore and never scorn you. And as we grow a little older, try to understand more of each other. I will be your golden eye, your master.
master of illusion or just your lover. I'll be a dragonfly, a butterfly, a secret or a little lie to test you. A song, a verse, a lullaby, a symphony once in a while to try and impress you. I'll take your heart to the limit, the colors of my joy, my tears to dress you. But sometimes, dear, my heart...
Chers auditeurs et auditrices de CKUT 90.3 FM, veuillez prendre en note que nos bureaux et nos studios de diffusion et d'enregistrement sont présentement fermés. Toute notre programmation est constituée de reportages préenregistrés, des archives récents, ainsi que d'autres programmations spéciales. Notre campagne de financement annuelle est également rapportée. Nous avons pris ces mesures par souci pour la sécurité et la santé de nos employés, de nos bénévoles, de nos membres, ainsi que de leur communauté. On vous remercie de votre compréhension et restez à l'écoute. Toujours avec vous, CKUT 90.3 FM.
Vous écoutez Les Bossons avec Nathalie Di Palma. Sur les ondes de CKUT, le 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir, nous recevons l'auteure-compositrice-interprète Van Hou, alias Vanessa Boivin-Drolet. Elle a été finaliste à l'émission Faites comme chez vous en 2015 et en 2018. C'est avec sa reprise de Dormir dehors de Daran qu'elle a réussi à séduire les coachs de La Voix 6, soit Garou, Éric Lapointe et Alex Nevsky. L'équipe de Laura Fabian étant déjà complète, elle n'a pas pu appuyer sur son bouton rouge. Bonsoir.